from KQED.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. This week, the Pulitzer Prize for Biography was awarded to John Lewis Gaddis, a history professor at Yale, for his comprehensive and controversial book about the life of George Kennan. Kennan was the author of this country's containment policy during the Cold War. He was the quintessential diplomat, the man who understood the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin. Although a conservative in his style, in late life he was a critic of America's role in the Middle East. His biographer didn't always agree with him. We'll talk to John Gaddis about the work that took him 3 decades to complete right after this. Again, good morning. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. While the Pulitzer Prize Committee couldn't agree on a recipient of the prize for fiction, they didn't seem to have much trouble with the biography category. The winner was George F. Kennan, American Life, and the author and prize winner is John Lewis Gaddis, a professor of history at Yale. Who would read a 700-page book on George Kennan? Most Americans probably don't know who he was. And those who do may have a hard time explaining why Kennan was so important and so interesting. Kennan was a diplomat, at one time ambassador to Russia, where he got kicked out, and to Yugoslavia. He is perhaps most remembered for an article he wrote in 1947 signed Mr. X in Foreign Affairs magazine that essentially laid out the containment policy that was to guide America through the Cold War. And the Cold War is Professor Gaddis's specialty. His course at Yale is one of the school's most popular. And we're going to explore Kennan and the Cold War and the controversy over the book. The book has been controversial. John Lewis Gaddis, welcome to Forum and congratulations on the prize.
Thanks, Spencer. It's good to be here.
Okay. I think in reading about you a little bit, I mean, the story of writing this book is fascinating in itself, but the Yale magazine had this story about you that talked about how you had to more or less tell most of your students what the Cold War was because most of them weren't alive during most of it. And the same goes for Kennan, I expect. Do you find it hard to tell people why a biography about George Kennan?
Well, first of all, on the students, it's perfectly natural that they don't remember anything about the Cold War. The Cold War ended at least 20 years ago, and most students are roughly of that age. So that's perfectly natural. At the same time, I find that the students have a lot of interest in it. It's close enough to their lives that their families were affected by it. Their lives in some way were affected by it. So it's not hard to get them interested in that. And then once you start that, it's pretty impossible to discuss the Cold War without discussing the career of George Kennan.
And it's kind of hard at this point to talk about George Kennan without talking a little bit about you. You started writing this epic biography, what, 30 years ago?
Well, I made the deal with George Kennan that I would become his authorized biographer, which meant that I had access to him and to his papers. But I also, we both agreed that the book would not come out until after his death. And the purpose of this was to give me complete freedom to say whatever I thought, not to worry about him looking over my shoulder. So that's what happened in 1981. But to the surprise of both of us, he lived to be 101 years old. He was 78 when we made the deal. He did not die until the year 2005. So that's really what accounts for the delay. It did not take 30 years to write the book. It was simply waiting until the right moment to do it by the terms of our own agreement.
You got to be pretty friendly with George Kennan over that period of time, and you went to his house, I think you said, at least once a year for a lot of years. He's an interesting character, as seems a man of contradictions in a way, described as conservative, kind of old school, and yet not completely. What was George Kennan like, if you can put it into a short phrase here?
Well, I did know him well. I certainly became fond of him. I certainly respected him a great deal. He was a man of great dignity, restrained manner, but certainly courtly and courteous and sometimes hilariously funny. The appearance that he gave was one of being fairly austere, and that was certainly the reputation that he had among the people that worked with him and certainly the people that knew about him. I was privileged to get to know him pretty well and to see that those were oversimplifications, that there were a lot of complexities in his personality. And, of course, all of this was greatly reinforced by the extraordinary papers that he left behind, and more particularly the really remarkable diary of some 10, 15,000 pages, which I think is very unusual in 20th century American history. It's probably one of the best diaries that anybody in the last century has left behind.
He wrote some of his diaries in Russian, didn't he?
He would occasionally resort to Russian, in which he was fluent, when he wanted to write about things that were a little bit too sensitive to appear in the diaries in English. Yes, that's right.
And most of these documents are at Princeton at this point in a special collection.
That's correct. All of the Kennan papers are now at Princeton. They've all been consolidated in the Mudd Manuscript Library at Princeton. And I believe they're all open at this point for anybody who wants to come in and check my footnotes.
All right. So now let's talk a little bit about Kennan. I think the reason most people, if they know him at all, is because of his tie-in with the containment policy in the Cold War. And right. From what I can tell, and I've been reading about Kennan for years, mm-hmm. It's never completely clear to me what he actually meant by the containment policy. I read one interview that he did on the PBS NewsHour, when it was called the McNeil-Lehr Report, I think. Mm-hmm. And he said he didn't really mean to contain the Soviet Union militarily. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think everybody kind of thinks that's what he did mean. So I'm interested to hear you talk about that issue.
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward what he meant. I think it's fair to say he did not always express this quite as clearly as he could have. But the idea was to find a middle path between the extremes of having another world war, this time with the Soviet Union on the one hand, and appeasing the Soviet Union, as had been attempted with Nazi Germany back in the late 1930s. Neither of those were very attractive alternatives. And so Kennan proposed, in dealing with this authoritarian state that had come out of World War II more powerful than it went into it and was dominating something like half of Europe, Kennan proposed simply waiting. He had great confidence that Marxism-Leninism would never take root in Russia, that it was contrary to the Russian national character. And the whole basis of containment is simply to hold the line and wait for the forces of history manifested in the attitudes of the Russian people, eventually to cause Russian leaders themselves, Soviet leaders themselves, to realize that this ideology was not working, to say that we have to change it, that we can't go on living this way. And so in the 1940s, in 1947, he really is anticipating Gorbachev, who comes along some 40 years later and says precisely that.
But the distinction between political containment and military containment, I'm not sure what political containment means, actually.
Well, George was not always clear on this either. And, of course, if you start with that idea that we simply have to wait for that period of time, that's pretty hard to persuade other people of. So, for example, the NATO allies in Europe were saying, well, we're not sure we can wait. The Red Army is in the middle of Europe. How do you know that they're not going to attack? And Kennan said, trust me, I'm a Russian expert. They're not going to attack. And, of course, they never did. But for somebody living in Europe in 1948, that was not very plausible. And so they were demanding a military alliance. And that is indeed what led to the formation of NATO.
With his blessing or without it?
Without it, definitely without it. He thought it was totally unnecessary, and he always opposed NATO.
Well, why wouldn't he be afraid that the Russians might attack? They had attacked all sorts of countries, or they took over countries at the end of the Second World War. And in America, the feeling was at this great anti-communist era that they were going to take over Vietnam. They were going to take over all sorts of countries. They were going to take over everything in Latin America. What would convince Kennan that that wasn't the case?
Well, first of all, he was a Russian expert. He knew a great deal about the country. Second, he was able to make distinctions. He could understand that Stalin was not Hitler. Hitler attacked a lot of countries. Stalin attacked very few. Stalin did take over half of Europe at the end of World War II, but that was as a result of the defeat of Germany. And remember, the Soviet Union were allies of the United States in defeating Germany. So what they were doing was moving into a power vacuum in that regard. So first of all, the record of attacking other countries, that was really not something that the Soviet Union was doing. They were hoping that communism would spread. People would voluntarily choose it. And that was the kind of expansion, I think, that Stalin was looking forward to. And it was the kind of expansion that Kennan was worried about.
And is that, in effect, the political where the political idea comes in, that you want to contain this politically?
Yes. Politically and economically, the idea was to restore European self-confidence. And so the Marshall Plan was a big part of that, rehabilitate the European economies so that the Western Europeans themselves will not feel desperate enough to have to vote communists into office. That was Kennan's strategy. The Western Europeans, though, thought that that was not enough. They thought that they needed a military shield, and so that's where NATO came from. And then fairly quickly after that, of course, the Soviets get the atomic bomb, and the Americans make the decision to build the H-bomb, and so there's an arms race that's underway. And that's also a kind of militarization of containment that Kennan was deeply concerned about.
Well, what about the fear if the Soviets got the atom bomb, which they did?
Which they did.
Isn't it a something to be afraid of?
Well, most people thought so, yes. But once again, Kennan said that, of course, we have it too, and that there is a kind of balance. It was not so much that he objected to the atomic bomb, but what he objected to was the building of hydrogen bombs, which were 1,000 times more powerful than atomic weapons of the kinds used in 1945. He saw no need to do that. But, of course, most other people felt it was better to be safe than sorry. And we know now that the Russians had themselves made the decision to build hydrogen bombs even before we did, although Kennan did not know that at the time. So, in short, what happened was, I think, a pretty natural development, which was an arms race. But this was something that intensely frustrated and frightened Kennan. And that really goes to say that he was deeply uncomfortable with any departures from his original conception of containment, any diversions from it, any developments of it, particularly in the military direction or in the direction of a rigid military alliance, bothered him a great deal.
Now, what was the context in which George Kennan was making his comments and making himself be known? The obvious one that some people know about was the fact that he wrote an article for Foreign Affairs magazine, 1947, I think.
Right.
But he was working in the diplomatic corps. Did he have a platform? Did people pay attention to him? What were his circumstances?
Well, for the most part, not. He was a career Foreign Service officer, but not operating at the top. He was serving abroad, service in the Soviet Union. He was a critic of optimism that many people felt during World War II about the possibility for getting along in the post-war period with the Soviet Union. He wrote repeated dispatches to Washington warning that that was not going to be possible while he was stationed in Moscow while the war was on. These went by pouch and so were never read, or if they were read in Washington, they were disregarded. So George many times considered resigning from the Foreign Service, and on one such occasion, early in 1946, he's still in Moscow, he's decided to resign. And so he says, all right, I'm leaving anyway, so I'm going to break all the rules. So he just said what he had been saying, but he said it in the form of a long telegram, of a cable. And that broke all the rules because cables were supposed to be short. They were not supposed to be over 5,000 words like this one was. This one was about 10 times longer than the normal permissible cable. So when that arrived in Washington, of course, everybody read it because they said, what is this guy doing, sending this kind of thing by cable? It breaks all the rules. But once they read it, it answered their questions as to why the Soviet Union really was proving to be difficult to get along with in the post-war period. And that really is what made Kennan's career, the long telegram. The X article that you referred to is the public expression of that. Signed X, and not with his name, because by that time he'd been brought back to work in the policy planning staff of the State Department, indeed to set that up. But State Department officials were not supposed to go public with their views, so it was published anonymously, but the identity of the author immediately leaked.
Right, and people still study that that document, that article today. Let me remind our audience, we're talking with John Lewis Gaddis, who was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for biography, and the book is George F. Kennan, An American Life. Professor Gaddis teaches at Yale University and spent 30 years researching, talking about, and finally writing this book, which was published after George F. Kennan died, which was 2005. The book was just published this year. Not everybody bought into everything he said, and he had some famous arguments with Acheson, Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of State, didn't particularly like him, right?
Well, it's more complicated than that. Acheson personally had a great deal of respect and even affection for Kennan. But he found it very exasperating to have Kennan working under him. There was a period when they overlapped in the State Department after Acheson became Secretary of State in 1949. And I can understand why, because George was very much inclined. Once policy was set, once there was a direction established, he would want the next day to begin reconsidering it and revising it and saying, oh, I don't think it's going to work after all, or maybe we ought to just rethink the whole thing. And that was constantly going on. He was a perfectionist in this sense. And so this is what Acheson found extremely frustrating, because Acheson knew the necessity in a bureaucracy and in dealing with allies of having a position that you stick to and not doing overnight reversals and reconsiderations. But George felt that unless you did the reconsiderations and the reversals, you could not really maintain the consistency and the logic of your strategy. And so that was the basis of the philosophical difference between them.
Interesting. In case our audience wants to call in and talk to Professor John Lewis Gaddis, 866-733-6786. That's Forum, 866-733-6786. We're glad to take your calls. Did the fact that Acheson, disregard the right word, but disagreed to some extent, did that curtail George Kennan's influence?
Not really at the time, because here we're talking about 1949 and 1950. And Kennan had already decided at that point that he was going to leave the State Department. He'd had about 25 years of service in the Foreign Service. He needed a break. He had an opportunity to go to Princeton, not to the university, but to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He wanted to do some writing and thinking of his own. So he was ready to leave at that point. It's not that Acheson did not fire him, as many people think.
He had been kicked out of Russia at one point. Was that after, or was that before the Acheson situation?
That's after. That's 1952. After about a year in Princeton, Acheson and Truman called Kennan back and offered him the ambassadorship to the Soviet Union. And Kennan felt that he had been preparing for this all his life, so he found it very difficult to turn this down. However, this is 1952. It's the last year of Stalin's life. It's probably the chilliest moment in Soviet-American relations, and the atmosphere in Moscow was intensely hostile to the United States. The Korean War is going on. There were allegations of germ warfare. And, of course, the American ambassador is followed, shadowed by the security police, which was nothing new in the Soviet Union, but it was particularly oppressive in that period. So after about 4 months there, flying out through Berlin, Kennan was met by reporters at the airport, and there was a mini press conference on the tarmac. And one of the reporters said, "Mr. Ambassador, how is life in Moscow?" And Kennan, most unwisely, responded that it reminded him of being interned as a diplomat in Nazi Germany 10 years before.
Which he was. He was in prison for six months, apparently.
That's right. But this was not exactly a politic or diplomatic thing to say in Berlin in 1952, just after you have been made ambassador to the Soviet Union. So Stalin immediately kicked him out. Stalin fired Kennan, in effect.
So, all right, this for me, this is fascinating. I'm not sure everyone in the world cares about diplomatic history and all this, but how would you say this is important stuff, what we're talking about? Why is it relevant to what's going on today, or is it?
Well, I think it's important stuff in the first place because it partially accounts for us being here. The fact that this idea of containment, the fact that this middle path between appeasement and war really was the course charted by the United States and its allies through the Cold War. And if truth be told, we were lucky, all of us, to get out of the Cold War alive. If you think about the amount of weaponry that was piled up on both sides, if you think about the number of near misses that took place, the fact that there was a strategy for navigating through this very, very dangerous period is extremely important. Secondly, I think it's important because the fact that we did this really built a different kind of world in the second half of the 20th century from what the first half had been. The first half of the 20th century was a very bad time. It was a time when authoritarianism seemed to be on the rise and democracy on the decline. And that was all reversed in the second half of the 20th century. And it seems to me the role the United States played in the Cold War and the strategy behind the role the United States played in the Cold War, of which Kennan was the chief architect, I think all had a great deal to do with bringing about the very great difference in the second half of the century. So in that sense, it's immensely important.
So it is important, and we will talk about why it's important, and we will take some telephone calls after our break. You can call us at 866-733-6786. We're talking with John Lewis Gaddis, who is the author of George F. Kennan, An American Life biography that just won the Pulitzer Prize. And it's a controversial biography. We can talk about that in a few minutes. The Nation wrote an article kind of criticizing in fact, very much criticizing John Lewis Gaddis. And it's an ideological dispute. It's a historical dispute. And we can get into that in a little while when we come back. So give us a call, 866-733-6786. We can talk about George Kennan and we can talk about the Cold War. I'm Spencer Michaels, and you've been listening to Forum. We'll be back in just a little while. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, and for Michael Krasny, we're talking with John Lewis Gaddis, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of George F. Kennan, An American Life. In fact, one of the emails we've got says, and I read this in some other publication, why did Professor Gaddis subtitle his book on Kennan, An American Life? It seems to me that Kennan, like Kissinger, was hardly that. He was European in thinking and the policies he shaped, and it seemed to me he was most at home outside the USA. So why An American Life?
Well, it's worse than that, Spencer, because one of the reviewers of the book said the subtitle must have been a mistake. And I was a little insulted by that. I don't think you work for 30 years on a book like that and then have an accidental subtitle. It is no accident. The reason I called it An American Life is that George Kennan, like Henry Kissinger, is actually a deeply dedicated American patriot. But being an American patriot doesn't mean that you are uncritical of your own country. He held this country to extremely high standards, some would say impossibly high standards. And much of his pain and his anguish about the country came when the country did not live up to these very, very high standards. I think that really is a parallel to how he regarded himself, because he was just as critical of himself as he was of his own country. And I think it goes back once again to holding himself as well as the country to impossibly high standards. Now, I don't see that as being unpatriotic. I see it being really quite patriotic. The story, the title, An American Life, really does reflect the fact that while George Kennan did spend a lot of time in Europe, his roots, his origins are deeply American, and that's what I meant to suggest there.
I think the implication of the question, and in the article you referred to as well, was that George Kennan really didn't like popular American culture. He was kind of repulsed by it, right?
Sure. So?
So that's a good question. But basically, he didn't feel at all comfortable with there was a quote I read somewhere, I don't know, the people on the beach and the people in the movies.
Oh, he didn't feel comfortable with automobiles, television, you name it, advertising, California. He felt particularly uncomfortable with California. You name it. There was a whole string of things.
Florida as well.
But California worse.
Since we're in California, what didn't he like about California, especially San Francisco?
Oh, he thought that people were too relaxed and laid back and were not working hard enough. And it was just a completely different culture from what he felt was more appropriate, which was kind of an old-fashioned Midwestern, almost Puritan work ethic. There is nothing hedonistic in that sense about George Kennan, and I think that's what he worried about California.
Except that there are more than implications that he had some affairs and had an interesting love life.
Well, he had a long marriage. That is certainly the first point to be made. The marriage lasted 74 years to the same woman. But he certainly did have affairs. I would not say that these were constant. There were repeated instances of them, but they were not going on all the time. He was not compulsive about this. The interesting thing is that he wrote about them, that he anguished over them in his diaries. He did not burn the diaries, so the references are there. Some of the passages that you mentioned that are in Russian deal with the affairs. I felt that I needed to deal with this in the book. It's an important part of the contradictions that exist within himself. But on the other hand, if you put this in context and really think about the generation that he was a part of, the generation that went through World War II, many of the most famous Americans of that era had affairs of one kind or another. And a lot of this had to do with the separations of wartime. So it was not unusual in that generation, in that context. And I think the discussion of this needs to be there. It's part of the story, but I don't think it should be blown up into something that is sensational.
That's why I didn't mention it till the second half of the program.
All right. Fine.
Okay. Let me deal briefly, and then we'll take a couple of calls. The Nation had this scathing discussion of your book and mm-hmm. an attack on you, essentially. Mm-hmm. Gaddis's views have drifted further rightward to the point mm-hmm. where responsibility for the Cold War rests on the shoulders of one man, Stalin. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They but implied in all of this.
What's wrong with that, Spencer? That makes good sense to me.
but the implication of this article is that you have kind of imposed your views on the biography, and that you're further to the right than Kennan was, and you disagreed with him on a lot of things. Kennan, for example, strongly opposed Bush's Iraq adventure, while Gaddis sounded like Dick Cheney on steroids during this period. Is this
make some allowances? This is my friend Eric Alterman, in the first place, who wrote that review. And Eric sometimes sounds a little bit as if he's on steroids, too, when he hits the pages of The Nation. So we did, Kennan and I did differ on various issues, including Bush administration policy, but other things as well. Certainly what was going on in the Reagan administration, we differed. We discussed this. To say that I imposed my views on the biography. You know, if you think about it, I don't see how you can write a biography without imposing some of your own views. You are who you are. And the possibility of writing a completely neutral, completely quote-unquote objective biography really is simply not possible. You can't even write history in that way. So every biographer is going to bring his own attitudes and preconceptions to the writing of biography. I think the real test comes if, having said that, the biographer is still serious in making an effort to reflect the views of his subject. But that does not mean that the views of his subject just have to be presented but not commented on or evaluated or criticized. Or praised. So I think that's simply comes to the territory of doing biography.
Okay. I might want to get back to this later in the program, but I think it's time to take a few phone calls. Here's one. Hello, you're on forum. I think you're not. All right. Hi, you're on forum. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Professor Gaddis, it's two pieces here. One is a personal comment, second, my main question. Personal comment is I was a student of Walter Lefebvre's at Cornell in the late 80s. So we read with some interest your work then, and I continue to enjoy your work. Looking forward to this piece.
My
question is, how is Kennan's concept of containment being used or abused vis-a-vis China today? Very different context, yet still we hear of containing China, which can set off the very different precedent that we faced after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to stay on the air for the question.
Fascinating question.
It's a good question.
Yeah.
It's a good question. And if you ask, where do you hear this talk of containing China most? I hear it from the Chinese themselves. It's their view of what we are trying to do. And there is a lot of interest in containment in China, but it's because they think that's what we're doing. I try to be very careful in trying to apply Kennan's ideas to situations that are quite different from those that he knew. And China, as it is today, certainly falls into that category. But if you think about it in another sense, great powers are always, in a way, trying to contain other great powers. Because if you talk about the balance of power, which is a very old concept going all the way back to Thucydides, for example, or Sun Tzu, it seems to me the idea of a balance of power implies that one great power is trying to contain or restrain another great power. So I don't think it's surprising that this would be the nature of international relations. I just think it's fascinating that the Chinese seem to be using Kennan as a kind of textbook to try to understand current American foreign policy.
But this
that
goes
may be a
this,
little bit oversimplified.
But it goes again, refers back to this discussion we had a little earlier, which is, what do you mean contain? Nobody's trying to contain China at this point militarily, I don't think. We're trying to contain China perhaps in Africa where they have making economic inroads. But where does containing China fall in all this?
Well, I think it really is in the context of the word balancing. China is a rising power, obviously, in Asia and in the world. We, the Americans, wish to retain some of the positions that we have long had in Asia and in the world. And so finding the proper balance between these two things is what's going on right now. But does that mean that we are hostile to the rise of China? If you put this in a historical perspective, as I tend to do, and go back about half a century and look at what China was like in the 1960s. And if you could have gone back to someone then and said to them, in 50 years, China will be a thriving, prosperous, capitalist country under the guise of communism, very much integrated into the global economy, we would have said in the 1960s, that's great. That's a really good deal compared to what it was then. So I think we ought to keep that perspective. And, of course, there are going to be rivalries with China. There are going to be rivalries with all great powers. That's very natural. But to see something exceptional going on here, see something unusual, I think over-dramatizes the situation.
Okay, we'll take a call from Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil. You're on Forum.
Yes, there was one book about Winston Churchill that alleged that Churchill saw an opportunity to end the Cold War right after Stalin died and that this opportunity was rejected by Eisenhower. What did Kennan, or for that matter, you think about this? Could this have been true?
Churchill was very concerned about thermonuclear weapons, as was Kennan. And so Churchill was one of the very first to call attention to the danger of a nuclear winter, to the need for top-level negotiations in the wake of Stalin's death. Kennan certainly would not have disagreed with this. Eisenhower was somewhat hesitant, wanting to wait for the right moment and wanting to be sure of who was in charge in the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin. But in fact, that first meeting does take place at Geneva in 1955 with Khrushchev and Buchanan and Eisenhower and Anthony Eden, Churchill's successor. So that was not too long after the death of Stalin. And it seems to me these opportunities were explored at that point. I think there were a lot of issues, though, that were out there that made it very difficult to end the Cold War, such as what the future of Germany would be. That was the biggest one, and there was no agreement on what to do about Germany.
Once George Kennan had left the State Department and kind of went into seclusion at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, did he try to influence American policy directly, or did he just write books and hope it might
pass? Well, it was both. He certainly was writing a lot of books. And there were two kinds of books. He was becoming a serious historian who himself won the Pulitzer for his first book of history in 1957. So he was very good at that kind of thing. But he was also going around speaking and talking on American foreign policy issues and occasionally writing books about that. So, yes, he was trying to influence American foreign policy at that public level. And then he remained, off the record and in the background, a regular consultant for the CIA during this period. Alan Dulles, who was running the Central Intelligence Agency, thought Kennan's advice very useful on dealing with the Soviet Union and on understanding what was happening in Eastern Europe.
What kind of advice? How do you influence
the CIA? Well, it was
just
a matter of the CIA calling up Kennan and saying, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? This could be the uprisings in 1956. It could be a whole series of things. It really extends all the way down to the point in 1967 when Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, defected with a major memoir that she had written of life with her father. And the first thing the CIA did was to get that manuscript up to George Kennan in Princeton and have him evaluate the authenticity of it. So there were a lot of contacts behind the scenes, as well as Kennan's own public efforts to influence policy.
We're talking with John Lewis Gaddis, who's the author of George F. Kennan, An American Life. You want to talk to him, you can call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Some email. Where did the term peaceful coexistence come from, and what happened? From Lotus.
Well, the term peaceful coexistence, as I understand it, is a term that goes back, I think probably invented by Soviet ideologists, not just by Khrushchev, but going back at an earlier point. It may actually go back as far as Lenin. I'm not sure. I would have to check that. But the idea was that there could be two different social systems, and at the same time, there did not have to be conflict between them. that was contradictory to other aspects of Marxism-Leninism, which said that the class conflict is inevitable. But I think what the Russians had in mind here was that it didn't have to happen right away. View of Stalin, and I think of Khrushchev, was that communism would in the end triumph, but this might be 15 or 20 years off. And so in the meantime, coexistence was possible. And of course, when both sides developed nuclear weapons, the coexistence really became much more urgent for both sides. So Khrushchev did, in fact, use that term quite a lot, as did his successors.
I have a sort of a large question. I don't even know exactly how to phrase it. But the idea that Kennan went ahead with the containment theory, and then he sort of sat back and he watched the next 30 or 40 years with the trouble within the Cold War and then Reagan and so forth. How did Kennan view his own role in shaping what went on? And was he more or less happy with the way it turned out?
That is the great paradox, because by all logic, he should have been happy with the way it turned out. It turned out very much as he said it would back in 1947.
The Soviet Union crumbling, the wall coming down in Berlin, and so forth.
But this happening peacefully because the Soviet Union itself had made the choice not to resist this process. And that is what he said was possible. He said this as early as 1947. And, of course, it's beginning to happen in 1987 to 1989. So I talked with him often about this, as did many others. And, of course, he would be interviewed on McNeil Lehrer and other programs about this as well. And he consistently said he was most unhappy about this outcome. He considered his strategy to have been a dismal failure when President George H.W. Bush presented him with the Medal of Freedom in 1989. Kennan wrote in his diary that this is a consolation prize for my failure. So why did he think he had failed?
Yeah, well, why?
It was partly because the Cold War had gone on so long and because so much had been wasted in the course of fighting the Cold War. And secondly, because the nuclear danger still was there, even though Soviet authority in Eastern Europe might be collapsing. The danger of a thermonuclear war breaking out at any time really terrified Kennan. And so that was part of what lay behind this sense of failure and frustration in the first place, that nothing really had been done to lower the nuclear danger. But I think there was a third issue here as well, which just comes back to George Kennan's personality. I think in the final analysis, his personality was one of being almost impossible to reassure. And he had always been like that. He had always been pessimistic. He had always felt himself to have fallen short. This gets back to what we were saying about holding himself to impossibly high standards. And so the ability just to relax and say, I have done what I set out to do, was something that George Kennan was just not capable of. He just did not have the temperament for this.
The sort of related point with his diaries and so forth, I think his daughter or his wife, I guess, made this comment that if you read his diaries, he's mostly pretty gloomy about what's going on. But she said, well, yeah, but he wouldn't go write his diaries when he was happy. He'd only write his diaries when he was gloomy.
Well, that's correct. And Annalisa, George's wife, played a major role in shaping the nature of this biography. And she insisted that it should be a personal biography. And she very much wanted me to get to know George as a person, not just as somebody who showed up in the documents. And that was for this reason, because she was well aware that his correspondence and his diaries were filled with gloom and pessimism. But, you know, if you think about how diaries are used by the great diarists themselves, they are often a substitute for a therapist. They are often a way of unloading your own anxieties. And certainly George Kennan used his in this way. So if you read the diaries, and if you only read the diaries, you really get the sense that he was deeply psychologically unstable and on the verge of a crack-up most of the time. When, in fact, that was not the case. So you have to take the diaries, eloquent though they are, with a sense of context here. And that's where it was immensely valuable to me to get to know him as a person and to see the sides of him that really did not get reflected in what he wrote down.
Interesting. With the biographer as shrink, obviously, is part of the job, I guess.
It is part of the job.
Right. Let's take a call from Tamara in Daly City. Hi, you're on Forum.
Hi. Did you say my name?
I thought I said Tamara.
I'm sorry. There was some interference. Thanks for taking my call. I have really, I'd like to ask so many questions, but let me just ask two. One is, and I tuned in about 10 minutes ago, so I missed some of this. I've heard it said that the Vietnam War is a vindication of Kennan's philosophy of containment. I've heard it said that it's a repudiation. And I was wondering how Kennan felt about the Vietnam War, and also whether the biographer sees Afghanistan as analogous to Vietnam, and that's why our military and our presidents are unwilling to leave. They feel that it's important to chasten the other side as much as we're being chastened by the war on terror.
Thank you.
Well, sure, thanks. First of all, the war in Vietnam, as Kennan saw it, was certainly not consistent with containment. He deeply opposed it and eloquently opposed it, and was certainly, if not the first, one of the very first establishment figures to come out in public opposition to it. He saw it as a great waste of effort because the idea of containment had always been to concentrate on the most significant sources of danger, and for him that was the Soviet Union. He never saw the fate of Vietnam influencing the course of world affairs one way or another in that regard. So he regarded it as a tragic miscalculation. And I'm sure he would have regarded what's happening in Afghanistan in the same way as he did, as was said earlier, our military operations in Iraq. Kennan simply never regarded the Third World as a significant part of the global balance of power. He was much more concerned about the relationship between the great powers. So his views would have been clear.
So was China considered, where did they fall in that? Great
power?
China
is very interesting. China is very interesting because in 1947, when Kennan first went onto the policy planning staff and when the nationalists were still ruling China, Kennan said, China can fall to communism and it will not create any harm. China is not part of the military-industrial complex that can influence or endanger our security in any way. He indeed played a major role in bringing about the American withdrawal from China and cutting off aid to Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese nationalists. And then when Mao did come to power, Kennan was one of the first to see that Mao would fairly quickly break with the Soviet Union and would become an independent actor in his own right. On the other hand, when Henry Kissinger went to China in 1971 to open up relations with China, George Kennan went to see Henry Kissinger afterwards and said, Henry, this is a terrible idea. So the paradoxes here are multiple.
Interesting. Didn't Kissinger review your book? And
yes, he did, and he told this story in the review as well. So I think what it boils down to here is that Kennan was no China expert. He was a Russian expert, but his ability to understand China, which was for him almost as alien a culture as California, was very limited.
All right, we'll take a call from Mark in Dublin, California. Hello, Mark.
Hi, this is a general comment. Paradox is good. It makes this kind of discussion interesting. I first came across the name of George Kennan when I was in high school, and I read his book, Russia in the West Under Lenin and Stalin. And I used it when I was writing a paper about the Nazi-Soviet pact that was signed just prior to the beginning of the Second World War. And the insights into how basically bought the Russians a certain amount of time that they knew that they were going to need in order to kind of build up their industry in order to withstand the Nazi onslaught that they knew that was probably coming, but coming sooner than they thought that it would.
So you want to comment on that?
Well, that's all pretty accurate, it seems to me. Kennan wrote about that in his histories. And, of course, he lived through it. But he was stationed at the time that this was all happening in Czechoslovakia and then in Berlin. So he was watching, in this case, the Nazis more carefully than he was the Soviets. And so the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939 actually was one of the few events that caught him off guard, that he reproached himself for not having foreseen. I think that he was just not plugged into the intelligence loop on that issue because he was in Prague at the time.
Okay, we'll take one more call from Neil. Kind of quick, we're running out of time.
Right.
Neil.
Just to sum up, if Kennan had never existed, would the course of the Cold War substantially have been significantly different at all? I don't think so. You had people like Harriman who were warning about the Russians at the time.
Okay, last question.
Sure, I'd be inclined to agree with you, but I think the timing would have been different. I think the idea of containment would sooner or later have been put forward by somebody else if Kennan had not been there. But the fact that Kennan put it forward when he did and with the force that he did, and particularly with the eloquence with which he did it, meant that I think the United States moved toward it a year or two quicker than might otherwise have been the case, and who knows what kind of difference that might have made.
All right. Well, with that, we'll end this session of Forum. John Lewis Gaddis, the Pulitzer Prize winner in biography, the biography of George F. Kennan, An American Life. It's a long book, I got to say, but Mr. Professor Gaddis doesn't even have in here half of what he learned, he says. It's an interesting book, and hope you will read some of it. Thanks very much for listening to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. Bye-bye.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.